In a universe that almost is, just out of reach beyond the edge of reality, mysterious forces underlie the fabric of existence. Energemetra 6, the very energy of creation, serves as both the elixir of life and the arsenal of destruction for its human and not-so-human denizens.
Crushing darkness, whose source they cannot fathom, grips the cosmos and its people. In anguish, they dream of the long-foretold bright star.
Join us as we embark on an epic journey, exploring the universe of Energemetra 6.
And I think we're live. This is episode, I think we're on 17?
I think so.
The podcast here. Welcome, Mel. And I have oldest and second here to read a couple of parts today. We're diving into From the Void. And we're going into the first story. Before we get started, let me hit our V for V ad. The Energemetra 6 podcast operates on a value-for-value model. That means that we hope if we provide some value to you in your life, that you'll return that to us in whatever way you can manage. If you're interested, head over to e6universe.com and sign up for our email list to get our free ebooks, and hopefully buy a physical book or some merch while you're there. Or if all you can manage right now is to leave us a good review somewhere, 5 stars or some kind of positive rating, that's more than appreciated. Thank you. And with that, this first story in From the Void is Genesis of a Dark Age. It takes place in Year 4, NST. In Ateria, the Aurora Galaxy. This is just after... I'll read the intro here. Thousands of years before the arrival of Brightstar, escapees from a dying Earth were transported through the darkness beyond reality itself to a new home. Though the colonists' physical safety was never in danger following their arrival in the Aurora Galaxy, the little group struggled to confront the horrors of a dark past that some wished simply to forget. Meanwhile, one-time governor Paul Kasizia and his twin children, John and Rachel, looked to defend this last free colony of humanity from a future far darker than they could imagine.
You can't keep taking those kids out into the void, Paul. They should be spending time with children their own age. Matilda Matheson's voice seemed too high-pitched to be real, even coming from her slight frame. Today her expression was particularly grim, as if it lay upon her shoulders alone to right the wrongs in the universe. She took her presumed role very seriously.
No one else has the strength to watch the redoubt, or ensure that we aren't attacked unaware, Matilda. Who should I leave them with when I'm gone?
They should have a mother, and you know it. Paul Kasizia didn't flinch. The hurt in his eyes was too old and well-worn for that, but his expression dulled for a moment under her onslaught. Shrew tongue, Rachel Kasizia whispered sidelong to her twin brother, John. He snorted in amusement, but Paul shot Rachel a sharp, remonstrative look. He shouldn't have heard her at all from where she and John sat yards away on the picnic blanket. Maybe he was using Energemetra 6. With her dad, she couldn't quite tell. Either way, the glance only lasted a spare moment before he focused his attention on Mrs. Matheson fully and asked, Riley,
who should they be spending their time with, Matilda? The other kids all know exactly who they are and how old they are. Everybody who came through the dark with us is still aging, and we're not. I notice you've got a few more gray hairs than you did that day.
Paul shook his head ruefully to take any sting out of his comment.
I'm not arguing with you, Matilda, but the universe we live in is far from perfect.
She barked a single laugh, her tone half humorous, half grim. Which one? We've been reborn, Paul. The old world is gone. We've left evil men like Lastus Raylan behind us. It's time to shed the remnants of that old world. None of that darkness can reach us here. Paul shook his head, now entirely grim.
I wish I could agree, Matilda. We escaped from Earth, but human nature is the same here as anywhere else. Besides...
He trailed off, obviously deep in thought. Matilda waited for him to finish. Then when he didn't, she huffed gently and shook her head, half smiling. Well, don't be gone too long, Paul Kazizia. There are still some of us who remember. She paused for a long moment, her attention an unfathomable distance and many years away, then shook her head again. She seemed on the verge of speaking, but something distracted her, and she craned her neck, looking down the slope toward the edge of the park. A moment later, John and Rachel heard what had distracted Mrs. Matheson and craned their own necks, trying to see past the trees that marked the boundary of the park. It was the sound of a crowd, and it was rapidly drawing near. Paul sighed, then glanced over his shoulder toward John and Rachel with a sour expression. John grumbled,
"More company."
The first members of the crowd began to filter through the trees toward them, and Paul's sigh became a concerned frown. Their eyes were hard, and Rachel saw a lot of unhappy faces among those walking toward them through the brilliantly green grass. Paul grumbled.
"Can't we just have a picnic?"
Matilda laughed, then pointed toward Hope One, 100 yards behind them, stretching toward the sky like a gigantic silver finger. Rachel grinned. "Daddy, you set Hope down in the middle of the city park. What did you expect?" Paul grimaced.
"It isn't like we've never done it before."
Rachel rolled her eyes again. 5 years ago. And they pitched a fit then, too. Paul grinned at her as he rose to his feet once more.
"Being a celebrity has to have some perks, doesn't it?"
His dutiful turn to meet those coming toward them hid his teasing smirk. The rest of the crowd began to break through the trees, and Matilda cleared her throat uncomfortably. "I think I'd better go. Good luck, Paul. Mind what I said about these young ones." Mrs. Matheson immediately started off down the hill the other direction, away from the crowd. Rachel frowned as she eyed first the oncoming mass of people, then Mrs. Matheson's retreating back. That was abrupt. I wonder why she's so anxious. Then the first shouts reached them. Most of the words were lost to distance, but "tech" and "ship" came from more than one throat. Rachel even thought she recognized a face or two, but any familiarity was overcome by a creeping sense of alarm. Why were these people here? Her dad obviously wondered the same thing. She saw him starting toward the nearest of them with an annoyed expression. She couldn't make out their words, but when the man gestured toward Hope One, it was clear that he wasn't happy. She scanned, looking for anyone her own age she might recognize. Or, she amended to herself, a few years older than she was. Last time she saw any of these people, they would have been 2 years younger. She might actually be able to learn more than her dad could, if she could find the right teen. There was no one she recognized, but she spotted something that gave her pause. Most of the crowd was staring at Hope behind her, or moving purposefully toward Paul, some with angry looks on their faces. One little girl, though, even younger than Rachel's apparent 13 years, was darting from one cluster of people to the next. Her movements were furtive, as if she were hiding. Looking around, though, Rachel couldn't see anyone who was obviously chasing her. Rachel had wished for a younger sister, or even a younger brother, for as long as she could remember. Her mom had died when she was very small, though, and unless her dad decided to adopt, the prospects of that were slim. She was a pushover, and she knew it. And she should probably mind her own business besides. Still, something about the obviously frightened girl darting from one cluster of people to another called to her. Rachel sighed and rose to her feet, then spoke over her shoulder to John. I'll be back. Don't let them raid our picnic. Rachel eyed the people around them, most of whom had stopped some way back from Hope, and were staring up at the vessel, seeming almost frightened. None of them were looking at her and John, one of the perks of being just kids. Nobody would notice her until she said something they thought was out of character. Rachel moved among the knots of people looking for the girl. A moment later, Rachel found her again. She actually bumped into the shorter girl, as the child, she couldn't have been more than six, rounded a little group of staring onlookers. Her head turned to look back. The girl started violently, then stared up into Rachel's face with wide eyes. Rachel grabbed her wrist and put a finger over her lips. For a moment, the girl looked as if she might wrench her arm free and bolt, but Rachel motioned toward the blanket where John was sitting, and after considering a moment, the girl nodded hesitantly. Rachel quickly led her back to the picnic site and sat, pulling the other girl down next to her. When Rachel released her wrist, she again looked like she might bolt, but Rachel raised an eyebrow and asked, "What are you afraid of?" The girl sucked in a breath, then hugged her knees to her chest, looking like she might cry.
"They're coming."
"Who's coming?"
John was looking around now, eyes sharp as he scanned the crowd.
"Where are your parents?"
"Gone. Not my parents. Seabird."
The girl's breathing was fast and shallow, and Rachel sighed in exasperation. Then, after a moment, she said, "Okay, slow down. What's your name? Who's chasing you?" She put an arm around the younger girl, hoping to ease her obvious fright, and after a moment the girl seemed to relax, at least a little, leaning into Rachel.
"Annie, I don't know what they are, but they're after Seber. Have you seen him?"
She looked up at Rachel, pleadingly. Rachel, meanwhile, had been looking for her dad. She finally spotted him down the slope, talking with one of the crowd. "What are you afraid of, Annie?" Annie looked around again, obviously frightened, but didn't answer immediately. Then, in a whisper, she said,
"Monsters."
Rachel's first instinct was to laugh, but the girl was so obviously serious that she was left more confused than anything else. If only her dad was there. Then, suddenly, he was there, standing over them, looking down quizzically at Annie. Before he could speak, though, another disturbance agitated the crowd. A knot of gray-clad men was pushing through the gathered onlookers toward them. Because of all the people, Rachel hadn't seen them until they almost reached her family's now-surrounded picnic blanket. Someone at the back of the little group was hollering,
"Make way for the council! Make way!"
Then something else about the little group registered, and Rachel let out a sound halfway between a laugh and a snort. "Daddy, are they wearing dresses?"
"Robes, Rachel."
Paul sent her a quelling look and stepped forward to meet the little group.
"Gentlemen,
Paul Kasizia."
The presumed leader, a severe man with an absolute proboscis of a nose, seemed less than pleased as he tromped the last yard or two through the grass to reach them. The rest of the onlookers were spreading out, and, presumably because the crowd saw the Planetary Council, the noise level in the area had died down. Paul nodded to the man with the huge nose, expression impassive.
"Reuben Stegler."
The rest of the group straggled to a stop in a semicircle around Paul, with grim expressions up and down the line. Only one or two wore open, friendly looks. Stegler cleared his throat, eyeing the incongruous shape of Hope One sitting behind them, and asked,
"You had to set down in the park?"
He shook his head.
"You realize this won't make reinstating you any easier?"
Paul snorted.
"I didn't come back to take up the governorship again, Reuben."
At this pronouncement, a sharp hiss of breath rippled across the gathered crowd and council alike. Rachel's attention was divided between Annie at her side and the men talking over them. Annie was staring around again, wide-eyed.
What monsters?
John whispered to her, keeping his voice as low as he could so as not to interrupt the conversation going on above. Annie shook her head, obviously unable to put her fears into words. Then the same bullhorn voice that had been shouting for the crowd to make way interrupted the adults' conversation above.
Paul, we need you!
The speaker had actually gone pale, and he eyed the crowd around him as he continued.
Folks are on the verge of rioting. They want to destroy all the Earth tech. We can't keep the lid on it anymore.
A murmur of agreement rose up from those surrounding them, and Paul looked around, startled. The man seemed desperate now, and his voice was pleading as he stared Paul in the eye.
You're the only one who still has the authority to talk to them, Paul.
Paul frowned in concern.
Is it really that bad, Standish?
Rachel was distracted by a crunch off to one side. From a distinctly open space, she turned her head to look, but there was nothing there. Annie went rigid against her, and Rachel narrowed her eyes, reaching for Energemetra 6. If there was something there, she would sense it through Energemetra 6. Nothing could hide from those senses, and she knew she'd heard something. As the colors around her intensified and her awareness of everything stretched, Rachel caught a glimpse of something moving slowly and steadily across the open space. At that moment, though, someone threw a rock at Hope One. It smacked into the vessel's side with a loud bang, and Paul's head jerked toward the sound. With an exclamation, her dad used Energemetra 6 himself. Rachel was reasonably good at manipulating the powers that underlay all of creation, especially after being taught by her dad for the last 10 Atarian years. But Paul's skill was so great, she couldn't imagine how he did it. Instantly, invisible barriers sprung up between their little group and the surrounding crowd. Anyone who was too close was pushed bodily, though not roughly, backward in a way. People scrambled to get clear of the invisible wall as it steadily expanded. Some were obviously panicking, and Rachel lost track of whatever it was she had almost seen. Soon, the little group consisting of the council, Paul, and the children had a clear space around them, 100 feet across. The same sort of strange barrier was simultaneously being erected around Hope, Rachel saw. When her dad got really irritated, he found interesting ways to show it. Standish let out an exclamation.
By the void, Paul! That's not going to help!
Paul snorted.
What do you suggest? Just let them damage our ship?
Indeed, the crowd was murmuring aloud. Though with Paul's barriers in the way, they couldn't get at either the group or Hope. A few pounded fists against the invisible wall, but that was obviously futile. Then Paul's voice rang out, amplified by even more weaves of Energemetra 6.
People of Atarria, please give the council room for discussion. We intend you no harm.
He grimaced as another rock bounced off his barrier.
But as of now, Hope One is off limits.
Stegler nodded sourly, his eyes sweeping the surrounding crowd.
You realize setting Hope down in the middle of the park didn't help either. The more we remind them of the past, where we came from, the worse they get.
Paul looked up at Hope with a thoughtful look on his face, but shook his head.
I didn't know, actually. When I left, there were a few murmurs, but it was nothing like this.
He motioned to the press of people around them, a few of whom had resorted to beating futilely on the invisible ring around Hope in obvious frustration. Standish spoke once more.
We know you believe there are still dangers from the outside, Paul, but without your help, there may be nothing left on Atarria to protect. Without Earth tech, we won't even be able to grow food, and these people want to destroy everything.
He gesticulated at the crowd, which was milling about, with more people pushing away from the council now and toward Hope One.
They're calling Eteria the New Eden.
He snorted derisively.
As if we could just go around picking fruit off the trees.
He eyed the fruitless, evergreen-like trees downslope balefully, as if it was somehow the tree's fault. Rachel's concentration was interrupted once more as Annie stiffened and lifted a hand to point at the barrier off to their right. There was a gap in the crowd there, but Rachel still saw nothing. Either using Energimitra 6 or... wait. There was something there. What was it? Even using Energimitra 6, the whatever it was faded in and out of her vision. She couldn't see or sense it clearly. Then it smacked Paul's barrier, and for a second she did see it clearly. It looked like a lumpy, misshapen child, but with gray skin and huge black eyes. Then it was gone again, and Rachel looked down at the girl clinging to her side. Monsters indeed. What was that thing? Shh, Rachel whispered to Annie. As soon as Dad's done talking, I'll tell him. We're safe in here. She looked around at the barrier surrounding them and shivered. What was that thing? And what was it doing here?
But Seber...
Annie's frustration had overcome her timidity. But though she twisted back and forth looking almost frantically for someone or something, she didn't rise from her place next to Rachel. Rachel's attention in turn was pulled away once more by Paul's voice.
So, you would have me become your king?
Paul's troubled glare raked across the council. Oblivious to whatever it was that had become momentarily visible assaulting his barrier, he seemed almost horrified rather than angry. The council looked uncomfortable, but one man, stocky and bearded, actually nodded, while several of the others shrugged sheepishly. Stegler sounded almost resigned.
Something has to be done. If not a king...
Stegler looked over at Standish, who had seemed about to speak.
And no, I don't care what you call it, Standish. It's a king we're talking about making him, whatever title you attach. If not a king, then what would you suggest, Paul?
A sharp, mocking voice cut in.
And so you would make him king indeed, even if not in word. Because whatever he suggests now, you will accept. Not without your grumbling, to make you feel important, but accept it you will, you fools.
The new voice came from beyond the edge of the council, but inside Paul's barrier. Everyone turned to see who was speaking, and several members of the council let out low groans. Annie, on the other hand, relaxed, and her attention fixed on this new speaker, as if she had finally found what she was looking for.
The Energimitra 6 podcast is made possible by North Arrow Coffee. North Arrow Coffee is the pro-life coffee company where 15% of every purchase goes to support organizations like Crisis Pregnancy Centers, whose purpose is to support women in the most difficult situation of their lives. If you're interested, head over to northarrowcoffee.co and use promo code E6 to get 10% off with your order.
The advertisements featured did not necessarily represent my endorsements or views.
And I think that's a good place to call it for today. We've actually hit our time and we're halfway through the story.
Awesome. Well, I made it.
You did. And you know what? You did fine. Don't sweat it. This is how you get there. Thank you everybody for being here. I appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to next week. We'll finish this story and on we go. And good job, Mel. Good job, Oldest. Good job, Second. Thank you, everybody, and we will catch you next time.